Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the show. I have got a quick read today, and a couple of quick updates with what's going on with the show. But today's quick read is going to be a really fun one. It's titled "The Resolution of the Big Block Experiment," and it's written by Lucas Newsy. If you don't know, that title, "The Resolution of the Big Block Experiment," is actually a play on Mike Hearn, who was a developer for Bitcoin, and I don't know how many years ago, I feel like this was back in 2014, maybe right around when the big block wars, started, and they kind of got into full swing, and a couple of proposals got rejected. Mike Hearn basically just threw a hissy fit and quit, and he wrote an article titled "The Resolution of the Bitcoin Experiment." And this is that's what this title is. It's a play on Mike Hearn's rage quitting from Bitcoin because he didn't get his way effectively. But Lucas Newsy has a very recent article that was just published the other day on Schnorr signatures, which is it gets pretty technical in it, but it's so good, and I want to hit it, but I actually don't have his permission yet. He was super, super jacked about me reading this article, so I assume he's on board with this, but I want to get his official permission before I jump into that one. And anyway, I've been sitting on this one for a while. This was published all the way back in December of last year, so it's like I said, I've been sitting on this for a little bit, but I wanted to say that I am going to try to, I have set aside pretty much the last of the work that I'm doing on the house, I've gotten through the last of the work that I am doing on the house, and we're going to be hiring out the rest of it so that I can fully focus back on this, on the Cryptoconomy project, and getting you guys more audio content out there to listen to. I'm digging into more discussions, more interviews, and I'm going to go real hard on this. So I'm going to try to get this back up to a daily podcast. Please don't shoot me if I don't make it, but I'm going to give it a shot because I still do have a lot of other things to do, and I'm still there's still plenty of other work to be done, but I am trying to commit and get back into this in like a big way. It's pulling in just a little bit of money now, and I'm seeing that it could be a real asset outside of the fact that I just love doing it. And plus, I'm starting to get to a point where I think some of the stuff I've been working on the background could be meaningful and valuable. Stuff that I've been working on for a while, as well as discussions with other people in the space, I think might be leading to something very interesting being built. So be sure to stick with me and share this podcast out with everybody you know, and check out the website at cryptoeconomy.life. Like I said, I got a lot of things coming, and check back daily so that you don't miss any of these awesome episodes and digging into the coolest stuff written and discussed in the Bitcoin space. So without further ado, let's jump into Lucas Newsy's Medium article published in December of last year titled "The Resolution of the Big Block Experiment." Bitcoin's unwillingness to hard fork is often portrayed as a failure to evolve, but the history of Bitcoin Cash has proven otherwise. Over the course of almost 10 years of Bitcoin history, dozens of proposals have emerged that increase the size of the blocks in its blockchain. And even though all of them have failed, the block size debate is still one of the most controversial, divisive, and tiring issues surrounding Bitcoin. Now, over 1 year after the creation of Bitcoin Cash and the ongoing drama surrounding its ABC slash Satoshi's Vision forks, the trade-offs are very clear. In this article, I'll provide the historical background of block size increases, its notable supporters over time, and how this ongoing issue divided Bitcoin on two occasions. Then I will make the case against such proposals by analyzing BCH's history and the technologies it employs. Finally, I will make the argument that, in the absence of block rewards, limited block space will be essential to retain Bitcoin's security model, as well as its monetary foundation in Austrian economics. The historical background. Block War 1. A contributing factor to the block size controversy is the fact that in the first iteration of Bitcoin, blocks were not explicitly capped. Satoshi Nakamoto only added Bitcoin's 1 megabyte cap in September of 2010 through a series of hidden commits that introduced the max block size variable. Before this addition, blocks were technically bound by a soft cap of around 500 to 750 kilobytes. Given the lack of transactions at the time and the significance of the other features that needed to be prioritized, block size was not a topic of contention in Bitcoin's early history. However, as more developers joined the project and began to consider the technical challenges associated with the mass adoption of Bitcoin, discussions on scalability emerged sporadically. Less than a month after Satoshi Nakamoto introduced the 1 megabyte block cap, the very first proposal to increase it emerged. In October 2010, one of the earliest developers to work on Bitcoin, Jeff Garzik, proposed a seven-fold increase to block size, to 7 megabytes. Like most of the early technical implementation proposals, which precede formalized Bitcoin Improvement Proposals, or BIPs, this was suggested on a BitcoinTalk.org thread. In this thread, Garzik argued that, quote, Bitcoin should be able to at least match PayPal's average transaction rate, and used this assessment as a justification. Satoshi was one of the first to respond to this thread and warned Garzik to not implement the increase as, quote, it'll make you incompatible with the network to your own detriment, end quote. Later discussions revealed that Satoshi Nakamoto was not entirely opposed to an increase. However, when describing a potential implementation, he implied that such changes would have to be rolled out gradually. In a brief post, he said that an increase in block cap could be considered, quote, inversions way ahead when, quote, obsolete Bitcoin clients constituted a minority in the network, thereby preventing a chain split. 2 months later, Satoshi made his last post on BitcoinTalk.org and vanished. Given the amount of work that needed to be done at the client level, developers that joined Bitcoin over following years focused on security and reliability rather than potential implementations of bigger blocks. The topic of scalability was only revived nearly 3 years later in 2013, when services like the Silk Road and Satoshi Dice increased the volume of on-chain transactions. And while the debate around potential scalability solutions was momentarily reignited, the shutdown of the Silk Road followed by the collapse of Mt. Gox prevented the formalization of big block proposals at the time. Bitcoin's price collapsed and continued to underperform throughout 2014. Nevertheless, the number of on-chain transactions nearly doubled over that year, which caused an increase in transaction fees. By the beginning of 2015, as transaction volume hit an all-time high, the block size debate was once again in the spotlight. This time, however, it was set to stay there for the following 3 years. In July 2015, Jeff Garzik proposed BIP 100, Dynamic Maximum Block Size by Miner Vote, the very first big block Bitcoin improvement proposal. beyond a simplistic block size increase as originally proposed by Garzik in 2010, the IP100 proposed the implementation of an adjustable block cap ranging from 1 megabyte to 32 megabytes, which was intended to be dynamically determined by miners. Under this system, miners would use block headers to vote for increases or decreases in block size at predetermined time intervals. A supermajority of 75% of miners would have to vote for an increase to take place, and that increase could not surpass 5% of the size of the previous block. Over the following months, BIP-100 was highly scrutinized by prominent members of community who argued that, given the dramatic range of block sizes, fluctuating transaction fees could contribute to more volatility in Bitcoin's price and even open up the possibility for network attacks due to frequent hash rate inflows and outflows. Amongst BIP-100 critics was Gavin Andreessen, Satoshi's hand-picked successor, who wanted changes in block size to occur in a more predictable manner and opposed to giving miners a disproportionate amount of power. His proposal, BIP-101, was to increase block size to 8 megabytes through an algorithmic schedule that doubles block size every 2 years. And as the trade-offs of the competing proposals became clearer, the Bitcoin community was critically divided. Three competing interest groups, which still exist today, were for the first time delineated. 1. The miner maximalists that want the miners to be able to increase the block size as needed. 2. The enterprise maximalists that mostly care about the technology's ability to scale. And 3. The hard fork minimalists that are against any changes in monetary policy. Unsurprisingly, the majority of the hash rate at the time signaled support for Garzik's BIP-100, whereas the majority of Bitcoin companies backed Andreessen's BIP-101. Caught between the two factions was the community of users and developers at large who seemed to have concluded that hard forks were by and large a bad idea. Prominent developers began to highlight that block size increases were merely temporary solutions, and that other approaches such as payment channels and sidechains would be required for mass adoption. Bitcoin's single-threaded nature, whereby all transactions must be verified by all nodes canonically, inevitably leads to latency in a situation where it is massively adopted as a medium of exchange, even in the advent of gigabyte blocks. As it became clear that the community was averse to a hard fork, Gavin Andreessen, along with other prominent Bitcoin developer Mike Hearn, grew exceedingly frustrated with the Bitcoin Core developers that opposed BIP-101. Both had already been working on an alternative client implementation of Bitcoin Core called Bitcoin XT, which had already activated BIP-101. Tensions were high, and it became clear that the possibility of a chain split in two competing networks was not off the table. Tensions escalated in November of 2015 when Mike Hearn accused Blockstream, which was founded by many Bitcoin Core developers, of purposefully campaigning against block size increases to push for their own sidechain solution. After months of pushback against BIP-100, by the end of 2015, the proposal was practically dead. Nevertheless, Andreessen and Hearn were still pushing for the adoption of Bitcoin XT with BIP-101. In December of 2015, a couple of months after the XT client was released, its network suffered a massive distributed denial of service attack, or DDoS attack, presumably engineered by an adversary of BIP-101. This ceaseless attack prevented XT nodes from communicating for weeks, which effectively killed the network. In January 2016, Mike Hearn published The Resolution of the Bitcoin Experiment and declared that Bitcoin was dead as it failed to adopt big blocks. The name of this article is a mock homage to Hearn's article, as I strongly believe the adoption of bigger blocks via BIP-101 or otherwise could have potentially destroyed Bitcoin's long-term value proposition. Block War 2 history repeats itself. Ironically, not even 1 year after Hearn's resignation and the dissolution of Bitcoin XT, the tiresome block size debate returned. The advent of SegWit, or segregated witness, proved that efficiency gains could be achieved without block size increases and served as a required path to Layer 2 solutions because it also solved the transaction malleability problem. Its proposed activation, however, faced pushback from the forgotten faction of the previous block war, the industrial miners that supported BIP 100. These miners wanted a compromise from Bitcoin Core developers, and in a meeting in February 2016, they expressed that they would only activate SegWit if the block size was increased to 2 megabytes, an agreement which was later dubbed the Hong Kong Agreement. This meeting was documented by the Bitcoin Roundtable Consensus and the topic widely discussed throughout 2016. A storm was brewing as the very same fundamental debate that haunted Bitcoin development for nearly 3 years was back. Its revival, unfortunately, was set to once again divide the community and drive people away from Bitcoin. During the Consensus Conference of May 2017, a closed-door meeting took place to gauge the position of Bitcoin miners and businesses regarding SegWit. Like the Hong Kong Agreement from the prior year, this group petitioned for the activation of SegWit and a block size increase to 2 megabytes in what was referred to as the New York Agreement. By the end of May 2017, less than 20% of miners signaled their intention to adopt SegWit without a block size increase. The 2 megabyte version of SegWit became known as SegWit 2X, and at its height, was backed by most Bitcoin businesses as well as over 80% of the network's hash rate. At the same time, some of the big block supporters began to campaign for the rejection of SegWit. Their unofficial leader, the CEO of Bitcoin.com, Roger Ver, was able to attract prominent supporters of SegWit 2X, such as Bitmain, in a bid to also support a chain split that completely rejects SegWit. To do so, Ver backed an alternative Bitcoin client called Bitcoin ABC, or Adjustable Block Size Cap, and announced a hard fork, deciding to call it Bitcoin Cash. Other alternative implementations, such as Bitcoin Unlimited, followed suit, and the chain split became imminent. Also revived that year was the Bitcoin XT project that already had activated support for bigger blocks. All right, I'm going to go take a quick break and grab another coffee, and we will talk about our sponsors. And remember that these are the guys that are helping to fund this thing and making it possible for me to turn this back into, fingers crossed, a daily podcast. Okay, and let's jump right back in with the birth of Bitcoin Cash, or BCH. On August 1st, 2017, Bitcoin Cash forked from Bitcoin. Its lead implementation, Bitcoin ABC, had a variation of Bitcoin's difficulty readjustment to account for the drop in hash rate after the split. This algorithm is called the Emergency Difficulty Adjustment, or EDA, which, as the name suggests, adjusted the difficulty in Bitcoin Cash's mining challenge immediately after the fork. This was necessary given that only a minority of miners allocated hash power to BCH after the split, and blocks still needed to be created every 10 minutes. As expected, the EDA successfully readjusted difficulty, and the first Bitcoin Cash block was mined 6 hours after Bitcoin block 478,558 by Via BTC, a Chinese crypto asset exchange and mining pool. Over the course of the month of August, mining pools such as AntPool, F2Pool, and BTC.com began to support Bitcoin Cash. During that time, both the price of BCH and its hash rate was highly volatile, and very few exchanges listed BCH for trading immediately after the fork. Like Gavin Andreessen's BIP 101, Bitcoin Cash's initial block size was capped at 8 megabytes, but it never reached that cap organically. Shortly after the fork, Roger Ver resumed his campaign to undermine Bitcoin technologies such as the Lightning Network and Blockstream's Liquid. Meanwhile, the SegWit2x drama was set to once again split the network. The 2x fork was scheduled to happen on November 16th, but on November 8th, news broke that it had been suspended. In an email from Mike Belshi, CEO of BitGo, he, on behalf of Wences Cesaris at Zappo, Jihan Wu at Bitmain, Jeff Garzik from Block, Peter Smith at Blockchain.com, and Eric Voorhees at Shapeshift.io, announced that, quote, "We have not built sufficient consensus for a clean block size upgrade at this time. Continuing the current path could divide the community and be a setback to Bitcoin's growth. This was never the goal of SegWit2x." End quote. With the demise of 2x, prices signaled some expectation that Bitcoin Cash could be adopted by 2x proponents, but that was not the case. As crypto assets across the board rallied in quarter four of 2017, there was a moment where both Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash coexisted without significant contention. Miners backed Bitcoin Cash, while most of the network stayed on Bitcoin, and both networks saw significant inflows of capital. This ordeal somewhat changed the community's perspective on forks, which is relevant to the BCH chain split. The other hard forks. Given the price volatility that both Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash experienced after the hard fork, Bitcoin Cash's hash rate was highly inconsistent. Just like any other cryptocurrency that employs SHA-256, Bitcoin Cash experienced massive inflows and outflows of hashing power. While there were very few transactions in the network, Bitcoin Cash blocks were inconsistent and confirmation times were high. As it turned out, the EDA was working against them. When Bitcoin's price spiked, miners fled Bitcoin Cash to mine Bitcoin, and vice versa, constantly triggering readjustments. Bitcoin was not affected by the outflows as its hash rate was orders of magnitude higher, but with every outflow on Bitcoin Cash, the EDA was triggered and block creation stalled. As a result, less than 3 months after the hard fork that created Bitcoin Cash, the developers behind Bitcoin ABC decided to fork once again on November 13th to deactivate the EDA and replace it with a more responsive algorithm. Rather than readjusting every 12 hours, as originally implemented on the EDA, this new algorithm was designed to readjust difficulty every 600 seconds, based on the hash rate allocated to the previous 144 blocks. The November 13th hard fork that introduced the new difficulty readjustment algorithm marked the beginning of a schedule of hard forks intended to add and remove features as needed. The Bitcoin Cash development community pledged to hard fork the protocol every 6 months to continually add functionality to the protocol. Despite the sheer lack of transactions in its network, Bitcoin Cash hard forked once again in May 2018 in order to support 32 megabyte blocks. This hard fork also reactivated a group of opcodes that were present in Bitcoin's first version that had been deactivated back in 2013 due to security concerns. For context, opcodes are the machine-level operations supported by the Bitcoin network, such as op-add for addition and op-mul for multiplication. Combined, all opcodes supported by Bitcoin can be used to design algorithms and make up Bitcoin's native scripting language, which is conveniently called script. Script is very much based on Forth, an imperative stack-based programming language that allows for simple yet comprehensive computer programs. For example, programs can be created so that if, op-if, a certain statement is true, a function is triggered. Conversely, if something else is true, op-else, another function can be triggered. As such, basic smart contracts can be created using the language, despite Bitcoin not being Turing complete. Unfortunately, script's functionality comes with serious trade-offs. In Bitcoin's first iteration, the deactivated opcodes that were added to Bitcoin Cash proved to be unnecessary attack vectors that, if exploited, could crash the entire network. Opcat, for example, was initially conceived to enable developers to concatenate two strings and link data points, such as signatures. However, opcat can also be used to create a massive denial-of-service attack by overflowing a transaction. An attacker could use opcat to concatenate two random strings and then use opdupe, duplication, to infinitely duplicate that string. The figure below demonstrates what an exploit would look like. Opcat, opdupe, opcat, opdupe, boom. Each round of opdupe coupled with opcat doubles the size of the stack. If exploited, the combination of these operations would allow for exponential memory usage, and all nodes in the network would crash when computing the transaction. When this vulnerability came to light in 2013 and its significance became better understood, core developers decided to retire some of the opcodes that would enable such attack. Since there was no easy fix to the exponential memory usage vulnerability, even simple opcodes like opmul for multiplication were deactivated. After the Bitcoin Cash hard fork, its proponents, most notably Roger Ver, pushed the unfounded conspiracy theory that functionality was limited back then because Blockstream had a hidden agenda to offer private smart contracts through its sidechain initiative. After lobbying for the reactivation of these opcodes, Bitcoin ABC added them to their client in May of 2018. In addition to the reactivation of these controversial opcodes, the developers at ABC and Bitcoin Unlimited also began to explore the creation of additional opcodes for greater functionality. That created controversy in the community and stern criticism from self-proclaimed Satoshi Nakamoto, Craig Wright. Prior to the Bitcoin Cash hard fork, Wright had quietly praised the ABC initiative for its lower fees, which was in actuality a result of the lack of transactions in the network, rather than bigger blocks. However, his involvement was limited at the time, but that changed in September of 2017 when Wright was connected with Jihan Wu, the CEO of Bitmain, Roger Ver, the Bitcoin.com CEO, and Haipo Yang, the ViaBTC CEO, in a Hong Kong conference to support Bitcoin Cash. Ver and the other proponents seized the opportunity and made Wright one of the main personalities behind Bitcoin Cash over the course of 2018. The prelude to the hash war. That also entitled Wright to make more active suggestions about the way Bitcoin Cash should evolve. And when new functionality was proposed, Wright made clear that he completely opposed the introduction of more opcodes. Unsurprisingly, things began to get contentious when the developers of Bitcoin ABC disregarded his suggestions. Against his recommendations, they pushed for the addition of functionality that was never a part of the original specification, an opcode called op check data sig verify, or opdsv. Additionally, they proposed adding canonical transaction ordering to the protocol, which was a 2014 proposal by Gavin Andreessen to improve block propagation, as well as a couple of other minor changes. Immediately after the announcement, Wright opposed the changes on Twitter, especially DSV, stating that, quote, "Op check data sig verify is not happening. If a certain ABC developer wants to push this, then we will just find replacement developers. Trust me, there are others." End quote. Craig Wright. The developer he was referring to was Andrew Stone, who had been researching ways to improve Script for Bitcoin Cash smart contracts. Why OpDSV is controversial? DSV allows the network to verify the validity of any arbitrary data string, thereby enabling Bitcoin Cash smart contracts to validate data from external sources. Just like Bitcoin's use of op check sig, which verifies the validity of a digital signature, DSV also uses elliptic curve cryptography, or ECC, to verify information represented as a signature. That information can be the proof of a transaction that occurred in another network, or the outcome of an event as reported by external oracles. Although the cryptography required in DSV could be theoretically implemented using Bitcoin's existing set of opcodes, the required script to do so would have a massive footprint on the blockchain of as much as 1 megabyte per verification round. DSV addresses this problem by implementing all of the underlying operations in a single opcode that is native to the protocol. A single opcode considerably reduces the cost of execution, as well as the amount of information that needs to be stored on the chain. Quote, on the surface, the decision by Bitcoin ABC to have all of the underlying operations of OpDSV represented as a single opcode is what led to the creation of the Satoshi's Vision faction, which sees OpDSV as subsidy. End quote. Since DSV requires a lot of computation if it were to be implemented using Bitcoin's native script, making it a single operation with a lower footprint, quote, would not be fair to the miners, according to the SV, or Satoshi's Vision Coalition. As a single opcode, contracts that use DSV would pay the same fee as a simple operation like OpMul for multiplication, despite its higher computational requirements. The essence of the problem is that, unlike Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash does not employ the idea of chromatic gas, whereby the cost of an operation is theoretically proportionate to how long it takes to compute it. Instead, smart contracts and scripts in Bitcoin Cash follow the same base price of 1 Satoshi, the smallest unit of the Bitcoin, per transaction byte. What that means practically is that the underlying operations of DSV have a much lower cost to execute as a single opcode than if implemented using Bitcoin's script. Consider that, if implemented through script, the entire DSV script could take up to 1 megabyte, or 1 million Satoshi, and cost around $2.89 in transaction fees at current prices. Conversely, OpDSV is priced at 1 Satoshi, a fraction of a cent. While Bitcoin ABC sees that as an improvement, Bitcoin SV sees the $2.89 as a subsidy that directly impacts a miner's profitability. If we take a step back, the issue at hand is the subsidy of computational costs through a singular opcode that computes all of the underlying DSV operations off-chain and only stores the results on-chain. Rather, multiple opcodes that implement DSV via script and stores all operations and its results on-chain. The problem of considering DSV a subsidy is that it implies miners will incur costs, other than opportunity cost, by having to compute DSV as a single opcode. In reality, however, not only are these costs negligible, they pale in comparison to the negative externalities of a 1 megabyte script. The ECC required by DSV could be computed on a TI-84, and its requirements do not burden miners in any meaningful way. Hence, all miners apart from the CoinGeek coalition have sided with the ABC side of the fork. Bigger blocks are a bad idea anyway. While an increase in block size may temporarily relieve network transaction congestion, it is not a long-term solution in any meaningful way, and blocks will eventually fill in the future, assuming Bitcoin continues to grow and be adopted. Still, the block size debate will not go away anytime soon, and Bitcoin Cash has been an interesting experiment to follow. After 4 years allocated to this discussion, the trade-offs associated with bigger blocks are much better understood at this time. On one hand, bigger blocks allow for more transactions to be processed on-chain. But on the other hand, they are a temporary solution that can dramatically impact the network in the long run. Increasing the block size through a hard fork impacts many distinct areas, and there are 4 reasons why we don't believe they are a viable long-term solution. 1. They are a temporary solution. Block size increases are seen as a vertical scalability solution because they do not circumvent the requirement for all nodes to process all transactions canonically. In a scenario where crypto assets are widely adopted, throughput requirements entail horizontal scalability solutions that can sustainably increase transactional capacity horizontally. That includes the use of technologies that have already been developed, such as Lightning payment channels and liquid sidechains, which allow for parallel processing. Mere block cap increases only solve the problem up until the cap is hit and, as such, are a temporary solution. No matter how many lanes you add, the traffic will eventually catch up. 2. Bigger blocks are hard to propagate. Larger blocks are unarguably harder to propagate under Bitcoin's basic wire protocol, which is based on TCP/IP. Under the 10-minute block window, a 32-megabyte block would take a long time to propagate from a miner in China to a node in the US. A 128-megabyte block would be extremely onerous to propagate to other nodes, even using more efficient propagation technologies like graphene, which further introduces centralization to the system. As a result, miners would produce a much higher rate of orphan blocks, which are valid blocks that fail to be amended to the chain because they were not propagated fast enough. Hence, the chain would have to reorganize more often, which opens up the potential for double spend attacks. 3. Less nodes decrease network security. 128 megabyte blocks every 10 minutes, which are full, will result in 18.4 gigabytes of data a day, 129 gigabytes a week, and half a terabyte every month. Users that run full node Bitcoin clients are required to store a full copy of the blockchain and incur the storage costs of running the software. Under 128 megabyte blocks, power users would not be able to run a full node, and it would be very expensive, even for corporations, to do so using cloud computing. The current directory size of the Bitcoin blockchain is 190 gigabytes, which enables most personal computers to run the software. However, if blocks double in size, Bitcoin's directory size will grow at a proportional rate, increasing users' storage costs. Consequently, less users will be able to run full nodes, thereby potentially increasing miner centralization, contradicting Bitcoin's ethos of decentralization. 4. What happens without the Coinbase? Bitcoin's proof of work is an effective security mechanism that has contributed to Bitcoin's 99.99% of service uptime in its roughly 10 years of existence. Miners collectively stake electricity to solve a computationally intensive puzzle, and this process makes it extremely difficult for an entity like a nation-state to attack the network. In proof of work, network security is subsidized through the block reward, which is intended to incentivize miners to keep mining, even when there are no transactions in the network. This incentive is split in half every 4 years, and in 2140 will reach zero. By then, the network will have to carry sufficiently high fees to justify miners to continue to devote hashing power to it. Otherwise, it will not be profitable to mine Bitcoin and hash rate will decrease, which opens up a big security vulnerability. Larger blocks reduce fees, increase the supply of block space, and make a fee market more difficult to develop. On the other hand, if we assume that most transactions will take place on Lightning channels or liquid sidechains, only large value transactions would take place on chain, which is a model that makes a robust fee market more feasible. The split of Bitcoin Cash marks the resolution of the big block experiment. I suspect SegWit2x was the last big block proposal to gain mainstream traction. As exemplified in the short history of Bitcoin Cash, the community that buys into the narrative of bigger blocks tends to centralize around personalities rather than facts. Inevitably, when there is contention amongst these personalities, the hard fork culture offers dissidents an easy way out. Quote, just hard fork it. This is the only death spiral that destroys value from sound money. And if the history of money has taught us anything, it's that when a society has the option to inflate its monetary base, it ends up having to take that option at some point. In Bitcoin, hard forks offer this option, and this is yet another reason to value immutability. What the Lightning Network has proven in 2018 is that scalability is possible without the need for impetuous decisions that have negative long-term implications. All right, and that concludes the resolution of the big block experiment. And this was posted on Lucas Newsy's Medium page. Definitely go up there and drop some applause on that article. Share that out, and don't forget to follow Lucas Newsy. Like I said, he's got a more recent article on Schnorr that I will probably, if I get permission, I will be wanting to cover that one on the show as well. It's a really, really good article, so if you want to get a head start, go ahead and check that one out as well. You can just find that on his Medium page, and it may even be pinned on his Twitter account. I'm not sure. Follow him on Twitter at, what is his tag? Let's find out real quick. Oh, at Lucas Newsy. Okay, so it's at LucasNuzzi on Twitter. But either way, I will link to both his Medium page with the actual full article, so you can check that out, as well as his Twitter page so that you can follow him and or check out his other Schnorr article. I post that in the show notes and on cryptoeconomy.life. So you should be able to get it on the anchor.fm page with the description. And then also if you go to cryptoeconomy.life when it gets posted up there. I've got a bit of a problem with embedding the audio right now that I'm trying to get support from anchor.fm on. So that may or may not be up there today, but I'm going to try to sort that out in the next day or two, or just resort to a fallback and do it in the old way that I had embedded the audio. But this article is a brilliant breakdown. It's just a fantastic overview of a lot of what happened with the big block experiment, or with like all the big block controversy and the block wars, so to speak. And there was just so much stuff going on back then. It was one of the craziest times in Bitcoin's history, literally. Back when Bitcoin XT and Classic and SegWit and Bitcoin Unlimited, like when all these things were trying to garner support, people were watching. Like this thing was going across like Twitter and Reddit, like it was a football game. People were watching and broadcasting node counts and hash rate signals, like flagging, like all these clients were different, like signaling for different support. And you'd find out, you know, like Bitcoin XT or Classic. I can't remember exactly which client was which in all these stories, but I remember there were these times where one of them would have like you'd find out that like 80% or 90% of the nodes were all just spun up on AWS servers. And then there's an instance where somebody like made a command wrong or something, and there was just a bug on their like actual installation, and thousands of nodes simultaneously went down, and everybody's like, oh, this is organic. There were a couple of bugs throughout, like these clients and stuff, as some of them tried to hit mainnet, and some of them were literally just proposals that were being signaled for that didn't even have real clients behind them. I mean, there were like seven or eight at one time that were all just cycling up and down, and you could see these charts. Coin.dance was a website that got really popular at the time, and it's still around, still a good website. I think they mostly support Bitcoin Cash. I don't know what happened to them with the whole Bitcoin Cash and SV split. But it's a really interesting, they had a really interesting thing in their like proposals page and like with blocks and node counts and stuff. So there's this really fun, you know, like sports-like chart breaking down who all was running with which crew. And it was just one of the most, just one of the most amazing things. There was so much, like, just so many fake nodes and just people cheating and being just angry and hateful everywhere. There were, like, just bots swarmed Reddit. I remember the change in Reddit when, like, it was starting to get really contentious, and suddenly there were just accounts everywhere that would just be arguing for one thing over and over and over again. Social media got just, and that's when the quote unquote censorship happened on Reddit, is they just started outright banning accounts, because it was just, there was no way to do anything. Manual moderation was just a nightmare. I can't imagine having to deal with it. I remember there was this really, really great thread that I was thinking was really like a productive debate on it all. And it got deleted, and I actually messaged the moderator. I was like, what, why'd you delete this conversation? I thought this was going really, really good. And he was like, man, look. And he like sent me an update of it, like within 20 seconds of him deleting it, because he was apparently watching it. He could tell from the upvotes and downvotes, because it was getting like 99.5% upvotes. And he was like, that never happens. So I'm always just watching anything that looks like that, because it's just bots upvoting it. And after it got to the top of the front page, they changed the original post to actually a link to a website that was going to like steal your coins. It was just a scam. It was just a scam website, and they started what looked like a legit discussion in order to get a bunch of people in it, and then they actually edited the entire original post to say something completely different and link people to scam. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. It's absolutely frustrating and annoying as the whole, like, it was so, like, the stubbornness was unbelievable, and you could not tell somebody who was had a legit concern with somebody who literally spent 14 hours a day posting about Bitcoin Cash. And I don't mean it like they spent, like they were just that devoted. It was obvious every single post they had was about Bitcoin Cash or this other thing. And there were bots on every side. Everybody was, it was trash across the board. But at the same time, it was one of the most fascinating things to watch in real time, because it showed a lot of the vulnerabilities that people were talking about, is that you can't, as soon as you introduce the idea of a hard fork, that's what the process becomes. There's no longer any consensus. Now it's just a big social media shit fest of trying to figure out who thinks what, and everybody's guessing as to how many people think, like, actually support one thing as opposed to the other. And you have these flags, it's like, oh, well, 40% of the network supports this. And then you're like, but those are 4,000 fake nodes. Those are 10,000 fake Reddit accounts. And everybody stands to make or lose so much money that they've all got incentive to cheat how much it looks like their particular solution is being supported. So it revealed how dumb the idea of trying to make some like social media or easily Sybil attacked like network signaling method as a way of just unilaterally changing the rules of the system. Like, the entire process, as beautiful as it was to watch unfold and how much I loved participating in it, it showed just how terrible it would be to, like, that was basically the last straw for me, is that, like, yeah, this is the messiest, most ridiculous process ever. Hard forks are a terrible, stupid idea. If for none of the other major reasons that it doesn't make sense, this alone, because there's no way to tell without being within the network rules, there's no real way to tell what network consensus is. That's kind of the beauty of Bitcoin, is that you don't need to have that huge process for everybody to fall on a shelling point for the consensus rules. And I actually detailed this out pretty extensively in my own article, how I didn't do it exactly the way Lucas Newsy did. I kind of focused more specifically on like the process of Bitcoin Cash forking, and then went into detail of like exactly the network problems. Like, for instance, Lucas was talking about how the hash rate went crazy volatile, and it was just like 3 months later that they ended up doing another hard fork to fix the emergency difficulty adjustment. I wrote an article titled "How Many Forks Does It Take to Get to the Center of Satoshi's Vision?" And I go into, like, I have two whole sections about the absolute insanity that was the emergency difficulty adjustment and all the stuff that was going on. And so if you want to dig more into all that craziness that was happening at the time, go check that one out. I think it's episode, if you want to listen to it, it's like episode 200. It was, let's see, I don't remember which one it was. Let's see. All right. Medium, blah, 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 crypto economy. If you would like to listen to it, click here. Episode 184. Let me shut this. No, shush, stop calling me. Okay, so episode 184, or quick read 184, is how many forks does it take to get to the center of Satoshi's vision? And I cover a ton of stuff going on. It happened with Bitcoin Cash at the time and the fork. And I went through a bunch of different bugs with it. I actually did not explore the opcat-opdupe bug, as he talked about, which I really appreciated him going into that because I kind of vaguely knew about it, but I didn't really dig into it at the time. I was just like, whatever, another bug, go figure. So it was actually kind of cool to have that detailed out. And there's a number of other ones. Those were not the only two problems that Bitcoin Cash has had in its short lifespan. So definitely go check that out, that article out, if you get the opportunity. So he talks about after the BCH split, there was still that plan to go forward with SegWit2x, which is kind of crazy because a lot of people were like, you know, if you want big blocks, you just got Bitcoin Cash. Like it was August to November, so it was like a month span between those two forks. And Lucas showed or talked about how at the last minute, all the major supporters, the core of the group of big businesses that were all trying to push for the SegWit2x, they backed out like a week ahead of time. But at the time, there were still, like, I think it was maybe BitMEX. There were a couple of major exchanges. Bitfinex, maybe, I think, was doing it. One or two major exchanges were selling futures for SegWit2x. So a lot of people had money on the line, and then they basically just lost it all as soon as the support got pulled. And some people actually still tried to go through with the fork. The network did actually split, sort of, because a very small like subset of the community tried to go ahead and just split off and get SegWit2x, thinking that maybe, I guess, fingers crossed, they'd get lucky and people would follow them. But Garzik, if I remember correctly, was the lead developer. There were only like two or three developers that had anything really to do with that. And a lot of people talked about the developers included because the entire thing was so rushed. It was like a week from, this is our proposal. This, we made an agreement and we are the businesses. And so you're going to listen to us. And that's just how it's going to be. And then boom, they had a client and boom, they're like, all right, the network's going live. And it seemed like the due diligence on keeping it actually secure and making it a reliable client had just been not done. It just like, there was no, like there wasn't any real review happening here. They were just like, well, this is just how it is, and we're the businesses. And the arrogance from some of their statements was mind-blowing at the time. I was like, I wasn't even, like, crazy against it, but the level of, like, we're the ones that are deciding how this goes, and just complete rejection of anything the users and the community was saying was... The arrogance was so powerful that I immediately was like, I don't even care if this is right. Like, I feel like this is a very, very terrible precedent to set. They're just going to do this. And like, even though there's just with that, without debate, without review, like this was just going to be some unilateral change that a couple of big businesses decided was going to happen to Bitcoin. So that was just not a way for me to get on board with their setup. And it turns out like all the major concerns were exactly right. And this was something that Lucas didn't actually mention in the article, but the client had what's you know, commonly referred to as an off by one bug. Now, I can't remember exactly like which way, like this is going to be a little bit inaccurate because I can't remember the specific details of which direction the fork, like block activation was off, whether it was like ahead of one or behind one. But it had something to do with the fact that they had set a specific time period from the activation and then a specific block that was going to be the hard fork block. But when they calculated it in the client, it was done with a math problem from the point that it was quote unquote like locked in, if I'm not mistaken. But basically what happened is they failed to account for like the current block they were on. So what happened is the block that everybody was waiting to be in the new fork versus the block where the new fork actually happened, they were one block away from each other. I think it was early that everybody was waiting for one more block for the fork to actually happen, but the network forked one block early. And so all the clients, literally, of the small group that tried to make SegWit2x happen, the entire network ground to a halt. They never produced a block. And in fact, had the Bitcoin network, had the major miners and businesses upgraded to the Bitcoin or the SegWit2x client, the entire network would have shut down. And the thousands of nodes and businesses that had all been upgraded to work with the SegWit2x would have immediately had to scramble to get a fix out while the Bitcoin network just did nothing. Or they would have to, the more likely option is they'd all scramble to revert back to Bitcoin Core to basically undo the hard fork. So had it even gone through, it would have been an absolute failure. It would have been one of the most embarrassing failures in Bitcoin's history as far as like bugs and network trouble. So there was a thousand different reasons to not be listening to these people at this point, but it continued to drag on for months and months and months while everybody said the core developers were stupid for being so, I don't know, security conscious. Then he goes into the 4 points that, you know, block size is a temporary solution. I basically, all of that 1 point about block size being a temporary solution is, well, really, I kind of cover all 4 of the points. But he's kind of got like those short versions, like detailing out the core of those arguments. I got an old article, 5 misunderstandings, I think it is, of the block size debate. And I go, with a little bit of, you know, back of the napkin math, I really go into exactly how big a blocks we would need and like how all the different consequences of like propagation and stuff. Like point 2 was that block propagation like really slows down the network, and propagating is actually worse than you would normally think. Like just kind of like on the surface you think, oh man, you know, 128 megabyte blocks, like everybody has to download a whole 128 megabytes, and that could take, you know, 30 seconds. That could take a minute. There's no telling. But that's not the Bitcoin network duplicates information over and over and over again, and it has to get through every node. So it's not about just downloading 128 megabyte block. It's about the miner mines the block and then uploads it to their immediate group of peers, which might be 8 peers, 16, 32, whoever. I'm not 100% sure how much, like, depending on the miner or depending on the pool, but they have their first group of peers that they download or they upload the block to. they're going to download that entire 128 megabyte block. And depending on the number of peers and their ability to upload, who knows how long it takes to do it. Like, they have to spread it to everyone that they're immediately connected to. So their upload speed is the limiting factor, not the download speed of, let's say, 32 nodes that are connected to them. But let's say we can all just get it at, you know, 10 megabytes a second, and it only takes 12 seconds for all. Let's be completely generous and pretend that it's no problem at all to have like a full gigabyte upload speed to all these 32 nodes. Best case scenario, right? So now they have to verify all of this data, which it is not, if anybody has ever resynced with the blockchain, it's not the shortest process in the world to verify a block, particularly if you've got 128 megabytes. Watch how long it takes to verify 128 blocks when you're syncing. That could be a general, huge 2 megabyte, 5 megabyte transactions aside, it could take possibly that long. Then they have to upload to the next set of peers. And that process to get from one group to those people they're connected to and the people they're connected to could take 6 or 7 hops to get to 90% of the network worldwide. That's a ton of computation. That is a ton of bandwidth. And if that takes upwards of a few minutes to go through that entire process, it's easy to see how the network could do this with, part of the network could do this with 128 megabyte block A, and another part of the network does this with 128 meg block B, and we just have a temporary split and really extensive orphaning on the chain. Because I remember that, like, orphaning was a pretty big deal early on, and the core developers worked crazy hard. It was so funny that, like, for, like, years, all they focused on was performance. So these upgrades would come through, and they would be, like, boring. Everybody's talking about transaction capacity and all these crazy smart contract scripts. And then these core development updates would come out, and it would just be, like, something that reduced validation by, like, 20%, which is actually a huge deal, but it doesn't seem exciting. It's not something that you can, you know, put on a sticker and sell to somebody, you know. It's very, like, high level, like the developers would specifically care about, but the user hardly sees anything different. You know, if your sync time drops from 5 hours to 4.5 hours, nobody knows, you know. Like, it might have a huge impact on performance and the amount of computation it takes to run the network, but it's just not seen. And I remember I was watching pretty closely, every once in a while I would go check the charts and data on the number of orphaned blocks. And it was crazy that there were, like, reorgs were really common thing early on, particularly when miners were not well connected, propagation was really slow, and validation and stuff was a really, like, arduous process. But after they made a handful of upgrades to reduce the cost of these things and speed up everything, there were, like, visualizers that I'm sure you can still find somewhere of watching the entire network come to consensus as nodes download and update to the new block. And, like, when the new block would spread, it was just like a spark of fire, like, all the way across this little animated globe of hitting all the nodes. It's like, and then everybody's got the new node, or everybody's got the new block. And that orphan rate, the number of orphans on that chart, basically dropped to zero. So while orphans were, like, a real problem, they had been slowly working on performance upgrades and ways to get around latency and making sure that people could validate most of the information and start moving forward while still propagating to other people on the network and so on and so forth. All these little developments kind of culminated into essentially orphan blocks being almost a thing of the past. Inevitably, there's always going to be an occasional one block orphan. So that's not something, that's just because probability is probability. But there had been 2-block reorgs, even 3-block reorgs in the past just because of poorly performing software or just barriers in, you know, validating and aggregating some of the information properly. And it was just one of those things that, like, at the time, like, I just kind of learned how meticulous and more details about the process of development. And it was just so powerful to see these key indicators that just continued to decline. They just got better and better and better as things went on. And, like, it just constantly validated that they had the right approach, that they knew what they were talking about, that these were the real engineers of a real network that was going to last for a century, that was going to make it through the end of the block subsidy. And that's why I take everything that the core development community, like 200, 500 devs, I guess it's probably 120 regular people, but tons of contributors, I think up in thousands now, is that they should be taken seriously, and that their process of incredibly painfully slow sometimes, but soft fork, like small blocks to maintain consensus and develop a fee market, like these are the long-term plans. These are the people that are knowing we need to plan for 40 years out, not next year. This isn't about Christmas season. This is about in 50 years, is this thing going to survive? And could this be the most trust-minimized financial network in the world? And I'm very happy to have participated in all of that utter insanity that you guys probably just got a teeny-weeny taste of if you were not actually there. Any of the OGs that were really active back then know just how batshit it got. But I have rambled so long now, so we're at 50 minutes on part 2 of this thing, so this is going to be a little over an hour. So I will close it here. A huge, huge, huge thank you to Lucas Newsy. Do not forget to check him out. If you're not following him, you're missing out. You got to follow him on Twitter. Follow him on Medium and drop some applause on that article. Again, I will have all those links available in the multiple different places that this will be posted. So thank you guys so much. Hopefully I'll see you back here tomorrow. I'm going to try to keep this up. We have a little bit shorter episodes. I'm not going to do this every day because this was a pretty serious one. But this was one I've been wanting to tackle for a while because it's just such a cool part of Bitcoin's history. And I love to share it with people who didn't get to experience it with us. So with that, don't forget to share, subscribe, follow, do all that amazing stuff, and check out cryptoeconomy.life. You can find me at The Crypto Economy on Twitter, and I will be up there, and I will be back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.